This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to take up several more landmark cases in the next year. Justices will consider a challenge of new abortion laws in Texas, the president's executive order on immigration, and another case about whether private companies should have to provide contraception to their employees under the Affordable Care Act. We look to the high court for the last word in these cases as part of our system of checks and balances. The court's actual power has grown since the country's independence, but it hears relatively few cases and fewer still get national attention. And that poses a challenge to reporters who cover the Supreme Court. But Adam Liptak has made a career out of that. He is a Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. He writes a biweekly column about the high court called Sidebar. And he's the author of To Have and Uphold, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Adam's going to be speaking about the challenges of covering the Supreme Court at Elon University Law School next Tuesday at 7, part of the university's Distinguished Leadership Lecture Series. But first, he joins us on The State of Things. Adam Liptak, welcome. Good to talk with you.
It's great to be here.
So we're talking about these challenges. You've been working for the New York Times in one way or another for 30 years now. And, of course, the Supreme Court is really a unique institution. What are some of the challenges of covering this body?
Well, lately the challenges are to write really fast. You know, these are big, complicated decisions. Citizens United say was 60,000 words long. That's the length of the Great Gatsby. And yet the demands of the Internet are that you give people an immediate take on what just happened. And that's really, you know, that really taxes the abilities of any reporter. And then it's a weird institution, too, because although in one sense secretive, very little access to behind-the-scenes stuff, very few scoops, in another sense, they do much of their work in public. They provide, as I just said, long reasoned opinions. They have public arguments. And the general challenge is to take complicated, jargon-filled legal material and, you hope, turn it into something accessible to an engaged, educated reader with no particular legal training.
Do you feel you get to know these justices? And how important is that, that you have a sense of who these people are?
I do feel I've gotten to know them fairly well, sometimes in social settings, mostly just by watching them think on their feet at arguments. And while readers appreciate a sense of their personalities, that I don't view that as a core part of the job. A core part of the job is to get a sense of their commitments, their habits of mind, their approaches to judicial philosophy, and so on.
One benefit of having a column like yours about the court is that you're able to give context and also sort of talk about the court in moments when it isn't in the headlines, to give us a sense, a broader sense of, you know, what's going on and what's behind all this. One of the things that you've been able to shine a light on is the relative diversity of this court compared to other courts in our past.
Well, in a demographic sense, in the way we usually talk about diversity, it's by historical standards extremely diverse. It's got three women for the first time in history, one of them Hispanic, first Hispanic in history. Only the second black justice, Justice Clarence Thomas, replacing Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first black justice. In some other senses, not so diverse. There's not a single Protestant on the court, six Catholics and three Jews. And all of them went to Harvard or Yale Law School. All but one served on a federal court of appeals. Four of them from New York City, every borough but Staten Island represented. So in some ways diverse, in other ways kind of cloistered, clubby, and a little bit elitist.
Has it ever been less elite? And in terms of political and ideological differences, again, these are political appointments. Has there been much diversity on the court in terms of background and, let's say, political ideology?
Well, in terms of background, no, for the reasons I just said. In terms of ideology, it's closely divided, quite polarized, reflective of the nation and our politics. The five more conservative justices, all appointed by Republican presidents. The four more liberal ones, all appointed by Democratic presidents. And that sounds normal, but it's not. It's the first time in history we've ever had a closely divided court where you could tell how someone was going to vote by looking at the political party of the appointing president. Mm-hmm. You only have to think back as far as David Souter, John Paul Stevens, even Sandra Day O'Connor, to say nothing of Warren and Brennan, all Republican appointees, all moderate left to hard left, that we used to live in an era where ideological commitment was not the only thing a president looked at. They looked at quality of legal work. They looked at filling the Catholic seat. They'd like to appoint cronies. And all of that means there was not a direct connection between partisan politics and judicial ideology. And now there is much more than we've ever seen before.
There had been some conventional wisdom abroad that whatever the president might have thought the ideology of the candidate was, the fact that they now had a job for life allowed them a little more breath and a little more scope in terms of how they would interpret these things. And some presidents were surprised.
Yeah, no, historically there's been drift, and the drift is typically toward the left. The last four appointments, the George W. Bush and Obama appointments, have all voted exactly as you would have predicted. So I think the presidents care more, and they've always also been able to unlock and make sure that they're appointing people, you know, who will vote as they might like. That's partly because they tend to appoint people who've served in the executive branch, whose politics are really well known. They're not out-of-towners like David Souter from New Hampshire or John Paul Stevens from Chicago.
You wrote a column recently about the fact that Clarence Thomas has not asked a question from the bench since 2006. I mean, you talked a minute ago about sort of watching how they think on their feet in oral arguments. He's somebody who just never asks a question. So, first of all, talk about the rationale for that, or the rationale he's given for never asking a question during oral arguments.
Well, he's given multiple reasons, but lately he says it's just rude to ask too many questions of the lawyers. Now, that strikes me as a little odd, because the lawyers have already spent months putting their best arguments in writing. The justices have read the briefs. So you would think the oral argument is an occasion for trying to probe and dissect what's been in the briefs, not to have them read aloud to you. On the other hand, he's not wrong in saying that the other justices ask too many questions. They interrupt each other, they interrupt the lawyer, and it's a little bit of a free-for-all. So he's half right, but it doesn't quite explain why he should be silent for an entire decade.
It's interesting. We talked about the paucity of cases. They don't really hear a lot of cases, and fewer still get to grab the headlines. And the ones that do are the ones that seem to come up over and over again, I guess suggesting in some ways, I'll put this in the form of a question, that perhaps some of the biggest questions before us will not be settled by the Supreme Court even after that decision. If you think about gay marriage or abortion, some of these questions keep coming up over and over again.
That's a good point, but it varies with the topic. So in same-sex marriage, they really have, you know, closed the loop on the huge civil rights issue of our era. And while there'll be a little mopping up and aftermath, that's done. On things like abortion and the death penalty, unless they were to do something completely binary, give a yes or no answer as they did with same-sex marriage, it can't but keep coming back to the court.
Also, cases vary in terms of their impact. Again, in same-sex marriage, the minute those laws and amendments are overturned, people are getting married the next day in those states. On the other hand, we have questions like that have a kind of ratcheting effect over time with a series of decisions. And I'm thinking now about Fredericks versus the California Teachers Association.
Yep.
That bears on kind of union power that has been eroding over time and the larger question of money and politics.
Yes, and that's an instance where the court really invited that case. The right side of the court is very eager to do some damage to public unions, to be fair to them, on a First Amendment theory. And in cases in 2012 and 2014, they just about said, bring us a case where we can actually resolve this First Amendment question. And a libertarian group promptly went into district court, said to the judge, please rule against us. We want to get to the Supreme Court as fast as we can. Went to the Ninth Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court, said, please rule against us. We want to get to the Supreme Court as fast as we can. And in record speed, they arrived. We had an argument. It sure looks like a 5-4 loss for public unions at a time when union power is already on decline.
Well, and I should ask you to summarize that for us briefly, if you would, what's involved here.
The question in the case, So if you're a California teacher, you don't have to join the union, but you do have to pay fees to the union for their collective bargaining activities. You're not allowed to take a free ride on their negotiations. The theory of the case is that fee violates the First Amendment, and it does so, the theory goes, because all of the union's activities are political activities when it's negotiating with the government, when it's trying to persuade the government to pay for better salaries, benefits, smaller classrooms, teacher tenure, stuff like that. that that's political activity, and it's a kind of compelled First Amendment speech to force that non-member teacher to pay for the collective bargaining activity. If it is political, earlier cases say that's true. You can't be compelled to pay for a union's campaign ads for the governor. But this is a variation on that theme, that collective bargaining itself is political, and therefore the fees are compelled speech.
And of course, there's a counter that stockholders don't have that option when it comes to their corporation and its political activities.
Exactly,
if you're
right.
A shareholder, you've got to have the share. So I've got about 30 seconds left. Name a couple of important cases we should keep our eyes on in the coming year.
Well, you've mentioned several of them. We have a big affirmative action case coming up out of the University of Texas. It seems like everything's coming out of Texas. And the courts, believe it or not, first opportunity since it called for one person, one vote to explain what one person, one vote means.
Sounds great. And we're looking forward to your visit. Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, going to be at Elon University's Law School Tuesday at 7 as part of the Distinguished Leadership Lecture Series. Adam, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Forsaken, the debut novel of a Greensboro author, Ross Howell. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.